Hi, everybody. I'm Judah Sanders.
I'm Brian Kiley.
And this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. On today's episode, we're going to consider some things that we ought to think more intentionally about and how that shapes our desires. Then we're going to talk about how to get better at doing things, what, all by yourself. And then we're going to unpack a newsletter that we have read and some of the key takeaways that we get about graceful realism, how to be positive, but not that toxic positivity, but a healthy positivity in the world. And then, of course, we're going to have a little fun along the way by playing one of our favorite games, Blessed or Stressed. All of that and more on today's episode of Engaging Culture. So, good morning, everybody. It is Monday morning, January 27th, and I am in the studio with none other than the legend, the myth, the apostle, the chief of chief, the king, the warrior.
This is retribution right here. I'm very clear what is going on.
Isn't it weird?
In what sense, I mean, I don't think I'm any of those other things, but in what sense am I a myth? That's where I'm curious.
You know really what it is, I think? I mean, I don't know how well different folks know you. But I think when you talk about how you live your life, because it's how you live your life, you don't see it as like spectacular. But I think when other people hear it, we're like, you did what?
You did what?
Like, anyway.
Just trying to live my life, man.
And listen, and we love it. We're trying to replicate it. Yes. We're trying to replicate it. What's the best thing you saw this week, Pastor?
Okay, best thing I saw this. I don't know if this is the best thing, but I am extremely intrigued by it and very curious in light of a few things. Number one, my general interest in AI technology. Number two, the conversation we had last week about TikTok and all the challenges with it being owned by a Chinese company with connections to the government and everything. But again, we were recording on a Monday morning, and I woke up this morning to the news that a Chinese AI company, DeepSeek, is upending the AI market. It is a relatively small, relatively unknown company, but they have released this app called DeepSeek. It is number one on Apple's app downloads right now as of Monday morning. The tech stocks are having some feelings about this. The NASDAQ is getting crushed right now largely because of tech stocks. And I am extremely intrigued. So I'm not saying best, but just this really intrigues me. Number one, that supposedly a small company from China is like lapping the competition of the best minds in the United States, where there are billions of dollars being invested. It's being referred to as the Sputnik moment, to the space race when USSR launched Sputnik. So I am very curious to see the implications of all of this, to see what does it mean for the advancement of AI technology. Obviously, what does it mean that it appears that a small company in China has made this advancement? And so many questions. So
yeah, can you tell us anything? Like, what makes it distinct? Like, why is it like taken off by storm?
So I have an article in front of me, but not the specific one I was reading this morning. Basically, its programming is just better than a lot of what exists right now in AI platforms, which is an extremely layperson's way of saying it. Sorry to those of you that are experts in this. But its algorithm is better. It performs better on both simple and complex tasks. Its programming is better, performing better on those tasks than a lot of American counterparts. So
I sure do wish that some of these companies, that sounds like it would be useful. But again, the Chinese Communist Party, I'm scared.
Yes, understandably so. So I fed it a few questions this morning.
Just you put it on your phone?
That's right. I'm basically owned by them now.
Me too. I text you.
Yeah, a few simple questions. And, you know, it was fine. I wouldn't say it was any different than what I get from ChatGPT at this point, but I don't know. I'm intrigued. We'll see what happens. I hope you have a better best thing.
I came across this article in the New York Post about these babies that were born in Auschwitz, who were born in a concentration camp during World War II, and they were...
We're just coming up to the 80th anniversary,
correct,
right?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. And we they were, like, given, like, no chance to survive. They were told, like, hey, not they, but the parents, whatever. It was not thought that they were going to survive because of the just terrible conditions of concentration camps. And despite all of the odds, and they have a wild story. I will let you Google and read it yourself. But they survived and have lived to tell their testimonies. And so their stories are being shared as a part of the commemoration of the Holocaust Memorial Day. And I just, man, I'll tell you, it is not a terrible thing to wake up to read about that despite all the odds and all of the, I mean, just really terrible things that they were born into, that they were able to survive. And now their story is just inspirational and exciting. So it's just kind of cool.
That is extraordinary. That is amazing. And that is definitely good news. We'll be right back. Pastor Judah, it was the poet Mary Oliver who said, "Attention is the beginning of devotion." Hmm. Attention is the beginning of devotion. And that is a much more elegant way of saying something that I have said from our stage before at Bridgeway, and something that I try my best to apply in my life, and that is the importance of the idea of paying attention to what we pay attention to. As you look at your life, by way of introduction, and he does not know what question is coming,
by the way. We'll see.
How do you find that what you pay attention to influences things like your mood, your outlook, kind of the general way you feel about life?
Oh, I mean, 1,000%. I mean, I've shared from the stage at Bridgeway before that I went through, like, this season where I was watching all of these court hearings and really just enjoying, you know, following these cases, and that I found myself being just far more naturally argumentative. And even the way that I was talking to regular people, having regular conversations with folks that I care about, I had taken on this kind of a lawyer-esque vibe. And and somebody actually, like, mentioned it, like, wow, you're pretty argumentative. And so I think, yeah, what you consume is what you become. I've said before, what you sit in, you smell like. And so I think that it is hugely influential. And I think what is more scary is the ways that it, what we watch, what we consume, what we engage in, shapes us that we don't notice. You know, the way that it shapes our thinking patterns and influences our biases and all of that. So I think, I think it's a huge deal.
Years ago, I read this book by a woman named Jenny O'Dell called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. And the book was okay. It wasn't great, but it was a little more kind of ethereal than practical. But in the book, she says this: it is with acts of attention that we decide who to hear, who to see, and who in our world has agency. In this way, attention forms the ground, not just for love, but for ethics. And that, to me, is such a powerful statement, because it really is true that we are, and I think your point about the show was a great example of this. We are formed in our ethics, how we act, how we behave, right? I certainly had a similar example with a show that I watched that I found years ago was making me argumentative. Or this is a really silly example. My wife and I used to really be into the show Scandal.
Come on.
With, you know, Kerry Washington as Olivia Pope. There's lots of sort of, you know, like, political drama and bad guys and everything else. And this is years ago. Like, I was first starting to work at Bridgeway. I remember leaving my laptop in my IDA cubicle at the time to go to the bathroom, which is a very normal thing to do. And thinking to myself, no, I can't leave my laptop unattended. They're going to get the secret files. And I had to remind myself that there are no secret files.
You know, it's funny, because when they talk about that show Scandal, there was, like, a very specific cadence in the way that the people spoke.
Yes.
And so I was definitely going to be very entertained if you were going to tell me that, like, you were giving those long monologues like Olivia Pope, you know, the way she...
I don't think I did that, but hopefully not anyway. But again, those are sort sort of silly examples, but then you begin to go, okay, what is shaping what I think about? What is shaping the way that I view the world? And it certainly is true. I think the silly examples about TV shows speak to a larger point, that if I am constantly considering what am I lacking? If I'm constantly considering who am I going to be angry at today? I mean, obviously we know that so much of media is just inflaming us and telling us who to be mad at. If I am filling my mind with those things, it is going to affect the way that I show up in the world. Isn't that right?
I think so. And I think the other important thing is that so often we talk about the intentionality of how we behave, of how we speak, but I don't think we talk a lot about the intentionality of what and how we think.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that the conversation about thinking is talked about in a way that sounds like there's not control over your thoughts, that you can't control your thoughts, which is really antithetical to Scripture. I mean, Scripture is pretty explicit when it says, take all thoughts into captivity.
Yeah.
And so for me, there's something valuable about rehearsing the reality that I have a ton of control over my thoughts and that I should be as intentional with my thoughts as I am with my words, as I am with my actions. And so I'm wondering for you, how are you cultivating a thoughtful consideration of the way your mind is working, the way what you're thinking about and how you're thinking about it?
Well, and I think more broadly, I think to look at what does Scripture tell us, and you gave us one example of the power of our thoughts and then what we are to give our attention to. Mm-hmm. Paul in Philippians 4, in a verse right after a verse that encourages us to pray when we find ourselves overcome with anxiety, tells us in Philippians 4:8, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise,
think
about these things, right? And I try to remind myself again and again and again, what does God call us to fill our minds with? Not in a like obligatory, well, I guess what I really want to do is, you know, read some dumb news article that's going to get me mad on the internet, but rather to go, okay, I want to be formed by considering the things of God. And I read a blog post this week that was a great reminder to me in that regard, that you and I think the point you just made a minute ago about we actually have power over our thoughts and we have power over what it is that we're giving our minds to, that is true. And you look at Scripture, who am I that you are mindful of me? That I might, just to give one example, consider the reality that there is a God in heaven who pays attention to us knows what's going on. And
us as individuals, like not just this kind of broad, hey, he has to pay attention to humanity, but like, yes, but also like Brian, Kylie specifically.
Yeah,
you know,
and each and every one of us. Or I think about, let me just sort of paint this hypothetical picture for us. Imagine the effect it would have on the world if all of us who are Christians woke up in the morning and our first thought was to remind ourselves that we are loved by God. Whoever is wise, let him attend to these things. Let him consider the steadfast love of the Lord, Psalm 107 says. Mm. Imagine if we were rooted in that. How much insecurity would kind of fall by the wayside, or at least be reduced? How much anxiety, and I don't mean clinical, but just kind of that, you know, that hand-wringing that comes from not knowing our place in the world or whatever. Mm. How much of that would the volume be turned down on? And how much would we be able to reflect the peace of Christ, the mercy of Christ, the kindness of Christ in our daily lives, right? Like, that's just such a simple thing, something that I admit I struggle to do on a daily basis, to kind of root myself in that. But it just speaks to the power of we are called to be mindful about what it is we consider, because what we consider impacts our lives in a tremendous way.
Yeah, so what are some of the things that you are finding valuable to consider kind of in as you're shaping your kind of internal world?
Well, I think that there are a few things. Number one, while I just said I struggle to do it, I do truly like have practices in my life where I try to root myself in the love of God, to root myself in the reality that he is with me, and not just me, but he is with every person I see.
What does that look like?
What is it? Well,
practically,
I think practically it looks like simple thought exercises of reminding myself that, okay, there is a God and this is his world and every human that was made in his image. And that is a little speech I have to give myself a lot, right? I think about even spiritual disciplines like time in the Word of God, where I go, okay, am I allowing this to shape me, or I'm allowing Apple News to shape me? These simple practices are not simply things we can do to check off a box, but rather they are acts of formation, saying these are the things I want to do to shape the way that I'm showing up in the world today. Because if I don't, I will not be then shaped by nothing. I will be shaped by the anxiety of the world. I will be shaped by the anger of the world, the fear of the world, all of those things. How about you? What does it look like for you to kind of shape your thought life and pay attention to the things that you're considering?
Yeah, I mean, I know that this is, you know, obvious, but I think you got to read your Bible. Mm-hmm. I have to read it. If I don't, my thought world gets dark and quickly and also becomes very susceptible to outside influence.
Yeah.
So I think that that's really important. But one of the things is, I think, to be intentional about considering what God has done.
Yeah.
And it's so funny, most recent Thursday, you know, I gave the students homework that every day this week when they wake up, the first thing they're supposed to do is actually write down, and I told them that they had to write it down, that they couldn't just think about it, but to write down three things that they're grateful for.
Yeah.
And I think that there's something powerful about that, because, you know, my grandmother used to say, in order to praise God, you only need a memory. You know, you only need to remember you know, what God has done and how he has done it. And certainly in your own life, but also, again, in scripture, there are all of these stories of God, like, really showing up for folks.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. And the last thing I think that there's something really, really valuable in terms of shaping your thought life about observing creation, nature,
yeah,
right? Like, there's really, I don't know how much we stick to kind of the original vision for the best thing we saw this week on this podcast, but kind of the original idea was that we wanted to be intentional about what are good things that we're seeing in the world and experiencing in the world. And I think that there's something valuable about just, like, sitting amongst the redwoods and seeing these big old trees that have seen so much happen in the world, and to say, oh my goodness, God gave us these and he made them beautiful, and he made them so that we can look at them and say that they're beautiful, and all of their complex biology is powerful.
Yeah. And I think in order to do things like that, it is in many regards sort of an act of resistance to so much of what we face in the world today. I mean, I do a lot of reading about the concept of attention from the standpoint of the commodification of it, that attention is a resource that companies are vying for. And so much of our economy today is driven by companies, media, social media, whatever, trying to draw our attention. And not all of that is bad. And I'm not, you know, sitting here going, oh, the sky is falling, whatever. But also, we have to know that we have to kind of get comfortable with the idea of maybe we're bored for a moment so that we can consider the things of God. Mm. Maybe we're bored for a moment so I can actually enjoy the trees instead of what's in front of me. It's funny, I came across an article in The Atlantic the other day, which ironically was written by somebody who used to host a cable news show, which is like the bane of just like trash as far as I'm concerned. But it was interesting to hear his reflections on it where he said this. He said that he realized that as a cable news host, a cable news show is powered by attention. It has no internal combustion engine to make it go. Yes, you can cover whatever you desire night after night, but if no one watches it, the show will be canceled. And in his case, that's almost what happened. And he just realized, like, nothing matters other than what can I get people to pay attention to? Not the quality, not is this going to benefit people, but it was all about how do I get people to pay attention? And this is the world that we live in, and we are being asked to pay attention to things all the time. But later on in the article, he says this, and this is where I think there is application for us as Christ followers. He says, if attention is the substance of life, then the question of what we pay attention to is the question of what our lives will be. And here we come to a foundational question that is far harder to answer than we might like it to be. What do we want to pay attention to. He says, if we didn't have all the technologies and corporations vying for our attention, if our attention wasn't being commodified and extracted, what would we affirmatively choose to pay attention to?
100%. That's a bar. And I think a lot about 1 John 2, 15 through 17, which says, do not love the world or the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, and the pride of life is not from the Father, but of this world.
Yeah.
And when I think about like, love is many things, but one of the ways that you can measure love is by attention, what you give your attention to, your time to, and your resources to. And so we're told really explicitly not to love the world. And in order, I think, to do that, we just have to be just really aware of our thought world and really aware of what we're giving our attention to, because really, like, the world is... It's not a passive thing. The world is actually competing for our love.
Yeah.
And I think if you can switch out the word attention to love, it makes it more serious, right? Yeah. Like, it's not just, oh, what am I giving my eyes to?
Right.
It is, what am I, like, love, right? Yeah. And to think about, how can I give my love to things that matter most?
Yeah. Yeah. There's another philosopher who said, who drew a deep connection between attention and prayer, that prayer consists of attention. Mm. It is the orientation of all the attention of which the soul is capable toward God. And I will be very honest. I'm not saying who it is because I don't remember how to pronounce their last name.
Fair enough.
Embarrassed to admit that.
Fair enough.
It's four letters. It's not hard. I can't figure it out. But
that's kind of funny.
They're Europeans. I don't know. I'm not very smart. But I think, to your point, that attention really is the grounds for love, and the things that we love are the things that are going to shape us. So we're going to link to the show notes of this great little blog post by somebody I previously had not heard of that talks through kind of 10 things that God invites us to consider. Mm. And we invite you, just as we would point this back to ourselves as well, to consider. What do you pay attention to? Pay attention to what you pay attention to and think about how that is forming you, and think about God's invitation to pay attention to those things that are going to be life-giving for you. We'll be right back.
So at the risk of sounding like hypocrites, because we have done so many segments on this show about the importance of community and togetherness and friends, we've been thinking a lot this week about how it is important to get better at doing things alone. And we've been kind of researching what are some of those benefits and impacts. And so I want to start just by asking you, why do you think it's important to learn to spend time alone?
Yes, certainly the irony of this topic is not lost on me. But I actually believe that there is a deep connection between quality time alone and quality time with others. And it is difficult to have one without the other.
Yeah, that's good.
I think about the legend, as you described him to me off air, and I would agree, Blaise Pascal, a philosopher from 17th, 16th century, something like that. And he famously said, all of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. And that's a very intense statement right there.
Mm.
But the point he is making, and this is in a pre-technology, as we know it, era, that we are so uncomfortable facing the realities of what is going on inside of us that we will seek distraction in anything. And certainly I don't think it is too far of a reach to suggest that he's saying that because we are so uncomfortable dealing with what's going on in us, that we live these lives of anxiety and one-upsmanship and who can I be better than, or what is my place in this group? And we go into the world sort of with all of these unmet needs, so thus we're seeking to take from others instead of seeking to give to others. That there is a sense in which when we can grow comfortable with ourselves in our aloneness, that then we can present ourselves more fully to the world as people who are connected to ourselves internally, connected to God, and ready to go out in the and be a non-anxious presence in the world.
Yeah, I agree. I think we also have just built a culture of entertainment in a way that I think we might have moved our base levels of like dopamine to such a level. And I'm not a psychologist, so listen, take this with a grain of salt and talk to your therapist. But I think that we have built a world where we don't grow up learning how to build that muscle and learning how to enjoy that. It's never something that is celebrated, you know, aloneness, which is interesting because as believers, like we actually have always had pockets of folks in under our umbrella who actually really understood this and they, you know, had the monastic practices and that sort of thing. But I think about how like our kids like have video games at, you know, 7, 8. And I, that's not wrong in and of itself. But I just wonder about the ways that culture has taught us to not just not have the skill set of being alone, but to avoid it.
Yeah.
That it's a bad thing.
We don't have to be alone ever.
Yeah.
We can be accompanied by any number of distractions all the time. And not all of those distractions are bad, of course, but true aloneness is optional in anywhere in society. And I think that's sort of the point I was trying to make earlier, that this sense of when we kind of opt out of aloneness, then we are not really able to opt in to community in a way that is as healthy.
Ooh, that's
one of my one of my spiritual heroes, Henry Nouwen, who I've read a ton of his books. I took a class on him in seminary. He, in his book, Reaching Out, The Three Movements of the Spiritual Life, talks about moving from loneliness to solitude. And here is kind of the point I want to make, is that I think in a world of digital distraction, in a world of digital pseudo community, so we're like loosely connected digitally to others, but we don't have deep relationships, we are struggling with loneliness, which is, I mean, that's obvious. That's everywhere. We are lonely. And even in our loneliness, we lack the ability to find solitude because we're doom scrolling, we're reading things on the media, we're watching things on the internet, we're watching Netflix, we're doing all this stuff. So we're lonely in the sense that we are not with community, but we are not embracing solitude. And again, Nouwen says that something that is crucial for our spiritual lives is we need to learn to convert loneliness into solitude. He says this, he says, when we live with a solitude of heart, we can listen with attention to the words and worlds of others. When we are driven by loneliness, we tend to select just those remarks and events that bring immediate satisfaction to our own craving needs, which is such a powerful idea to go, if I'm going out into the world, like this is the point I was making earlier, craving, how much more of an anxious presence am I going to be? Whereas if I learn to embrace solitude, then I actually am going to be able to show up for others. One more quote from Nouwen, and then we'll throw it back to you. He says this, to live a spiritual life, we must first find the courage to enter into the desert of our loneliness and change it by gentle and persistent efforts into a garden of solitude. This requires not only courage, but a strong faith. And he says the movement from loneliness to solitude is the beginning of any spiritual life because it is a movement from the restless senses to a restful spirit, from outward reaching cravings to the inward reaching search to kind of understand ourselves. So yeah, I think that's the irony of it. We are bad at being with people in part because we are bad at being alone, and that creates all sorts of issues.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, I mean, we really see Jesus have this balance down, right? Because he was with his people all the time, his disciples, his tribe, his friends, consistently. But there are all of these scriptures that talk about, you know, very early in the morning, Jesus would get up and go to the solitary place. Then Jesus withdrew from the crowds and went to the solitary place. And Jesus pulled away and he prayed. And so just as believers, you know, I something that I try to frame my Christian practice in is the idea of not just like looking at, you know, the spiritual things that Jesus like said and he taught and those principles, but also to like pay a lot of attention to like practically, how did dude live? How did he move in the world?
Yeah.
And I think that that's a part of being Christ-like is learning how to do it. I think the challenge is, I think people will hear this and say, yeah, that sounds accurate, but how do we do it? Yeah. How do we learn? Especially when I literally was just talking to one of my students about this very topic last night. And what I know about this particular student is that it is very difficult for them to be still and to be quiet. They, like, especially when... I guess we're going to muddy the stream with this, but like I'm a 7 on the Enneagram.
Yeah.
And so our highest priority is experiences.
Yep.
And so somebody like me might say, but it's so uncomfortable and it's so painful and I just don't even know where to begin. Yep. What would you recommend?
Yeah. And I've kind of soured on the Enneagram a little bit, but I identify as a 7 as well.
Ooh, let's come back and, to that. I'm curious as to why.
And I identify as a 7 in terms of, yeah, I'm all about, I want experiences, I want fun, I want all of those things. So I get that. And for me, to be able to be comfortable truly being alone has been a discipline. So even so my advice to a person in that state, as this is advice I've practiced myself, is start small. It is kind of funny to me how rarely I listen to something in the car now. Almost never.
Mm.
And my drives are short. So it's not like if I had an hour commute, it would be different, but I don't have an hour commute. And I've come to sort of relish that time as just time to let my mind wander, to pay attention to how my body is feeling, both physically and psychologically and emotionally and everything else. I think we need to create small places where we are comfortable with kind of not having a bunch of external stimulus. I've developed the discipline, and I would say I'm 90% on this, that if I show up for an appointment or a meeting or something, and I'm waiting for the other person, and I know it's going to be a relatively short wait, I don't pull out my phone, right? And I just take 3 to 5 minutes to just sort of
That's
sit there.
So practical.
I did this on Friday. In the history of my men's group, I was the first one there. And I was tempted to get out my phone. And instead, I just sat there. And I observed what was going on in the coffee shop. I prayed the Lord's Prayer. And I just sort of breathed for a moment. And I've actually come to really, even though I still have that impulse to grab my phone, it's almost like, oh yeah, I can sit and do nothing for a second and just be present with myself and with what's going on around me. So those are some simple things that have been helpful for me. I know that you, while you are a 7, you also are an introvert.
Yeah, I
you,
don't really struggle you too much solitude.
You recharge by being alone. Mm. How have you found aloneness or solitude to be beneficial? And then even how have you navigated that space between kind of regenerative solitude and maybe kind of, I don't know, less regenerative, or I hesitate to say wasteful, but just kind of, you know, that time where you're by yourself, but it doesn't really help in terms of rest and regeneration.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One, I think that what I have found so beneficial about solitude and alone time, one of the things is that it is a space where I am not at all tempted to be in any way performative.
Yeah.
And I find that that is really, really important because so much of what I do is front-facing and presentation oriented. And so I need to have constant spaces and times where I'm not in that headspace because it becomes very easy to lose who you are when you are doing work that, you know, is presenting, is front-facing, and does have need strategy.
Yep.
And so I think it's nice to just sit with me. I remember one time I was in Switzerland. And I had met some people there, and we were all going to go to the Swiss, to the Alps, together. And then, like, at the last minute, I just felt like I should do that trek alone. And so I did. And when I got to the top, it was just breathtakingly beautiful at the top of one of the Swiss Alps. And I was very, very emotional and, like, undignifiedly emotional.
Yeah,
and
wow.
I realized that the only reason that I was allowed to have, like, that very ugly, snotty cry was because I was alone. Mm. And that I might not have given myself permission to feel all of the things I needed to feel if I had been with other people.
Gosh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
I think, I'll show you the video or the pictures.
Maybe the crying's not beautiful.
Not the crying.
But,
I'm not into
it. What a great example of, like, okay, there was obviously some internal work you needed to do and some emotion that needed to get out. And to your point, there's no need to perform, to hold it together, to be somebody
None
for somebody else. You're able to just be fully present to what was going on with you, maybe what God was dealing with you at the time. And there's such value in that. And I'm sure it affected the way you showed up to the people that you were with following that.
I think so. And I think to the second part of your question, which is how does my aloneness and my desire for alone time show up in unhealthy ways? And when, you know, my mental health really ebbs and flows, and when I am kind of depressed, I tend to do all of my time alone except for what I absolutely have to be with other people to do because of, you know, responsibilities and commitments. And I find that in those seasons, I have a tendency to just kind of curl up in my room, and that is not healthy. And so I think that there really is something not just to alone time, but as you said, to the quality of your alone time. And like, how do you engage with that? And so one of the things that I think is healthy is to structure alone time with a lot of intentionality. Whereas I think a lot of us, all of our alone time is just the alone time that we accidentally fall into. It is something
that's
like,
good.
I got to the doctor's office too early and now I'm just sitting here or whatever. But I think, what does it look like to be purposeful and say, where can I build in alone time? And one of the ways that that, you know, historically Christians have done this, but we don't talk a lot about in the modern church, is having a meditative practice, right? Having a practice of, hey, I'm going to sit still and quiet. The Bible says, be still and know.
Cease striving, some translations say.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. And so what are some ways that you structure your alone time that are beneficial? What are some ways that you make your alone time quality?
Yeah, like I said, I think just finding those pockets of time where I don't, where I'm not receiving some sort of input, right? So whether that's reading, whether that's listening to a podcast, whether that is even in conversation or listening to music. I have found, as much as I love learning and as much as I love growing, that having those spaces in my life where I'm just sort of okay, that there's not anything else going on. I think I am somewhat unique for someone in my season of life in that it is somewhat easy for me to find at least a little bit of alone time because my day off is Friday and my wife and kids are at work on my day off. Now, I tend to structure things a little bit differently than a traditional day off so that I can maximize time at home, you know, on the weekend. So I'll do a little bit of work here and there, but even if I do, it's usually by myself. My main hobby right now is running and exercise, which I typically do by myself. And I think just kind of finding those spaces where I can go, all right, how do I settle down the noise a little bit, just sort of be who I am, connect with the Lord, connect with kind of what I'm doing, and allow myself to kind of settle that anxiety that almost comes from not having anything to do and getting a little bit more comfortable being alone. So I don't know. Those are like, I feel that's all very vague, but I think that it kind of to the point I was making earlier about what advice would I give, you experience solitude as a discipline before it becomes a delight. And that's true for a lot of things, right? Like, and in the same manner that I would not say, hey, you're brand new to weightlifting, 150-pound dude, let's put you on the bench press at 225 and see how it goes. I would not say to somebody who is just trying to first understand kind of the benefits of solitude, hey, go on a day-long silent retreat, or even, hey, try to just sit in a room and do nothing for an hour. I'd say, okay, try on your 5-minute commute.
Yeah.
Don't turn something on.
I right? wouldn't start with a full day.
Go out and go for a walk and leave your headphones at home, right? Like, just let's try these small things and pay attention to how you feel. Like, pay attention to the discomfort. Notice it. Allow yourself to acknowledge it. Don't beat yourself up for it. And then what I've found is as I've kind of, I don't know, this sounds a little cheesy, but sort of made friends with the weird feelings I have when I don't have any input, and I've just kind of been able to notice the anxiety that it provokes, I'm able to settle down a little bit. I'm able to be a little bit more present. I'm able to pay attention to what's going on inside of me, which, if I'm being honest, is not always something I want to deal with. There's a reason why we want to distract ourselves.
100%.
And those are just some ways.
You know, once Dr. Cesare Fletcher, I'm a part of the Sacramento Theological Friendship Circle, which is a cohort that she kind of put together. Mm-hmm. Pastor Phyllis Towles is in it. And anyway, so once she took us on a silent retreat and like, listen, that first day was fine. That first day was lovely. But the idea of like all we were allowed to bring is our Bibles and something to write with.
Yeah.
And we had to be absolutely quiet. And I just like remember like when the people who were cleaning the retreat center would like walk by with the trash cans, I was like, talk to me. You know, it just really was hard. And another funny thing is, so just as a resource, there are Christian silent retreats all over the country.
Yeah.
And I actually really recommend doing one at least one time. But there's a common experience that on about day three of doing like a silent retreat, often, and this is just random, I don't even know that it's helpful, often for some reason, people get super gassy when they've been silent.
I've heard about this.
Yeah,
I've heard
it's like this. A real thing. And I think yeah. I think that there's something funny about that.
So I do not wish to comment on the flatulence element, but I do want to comment on something you just said, how, okay, you spend all this time alone and all of a sudden you have someone come into your space and you're so interested in talking with them.
Yeah, that's
right?
Deep, right?
I think there's something to be said for withdrawal puts us in a better headspace to appreciate community.
Ooh.
And we can over-withdraw,
that's
certainly.
That's a book title.
We can over-withdraw. We can withdraw in a way that now makes community seem boring because we're comparing it to video games or entertainment or whatever.
Come on.
Or we can withdraw in a way that helps us realize the blessing of community. So would encourage you, think about what does it look like to find alone time spaces that can help you quiet down, pay attention to what's going on with you, pay attention to what God is doing in you, and help cultivate just your ability to be a non-anxious presence in the world. We'll be right back. We are back, and Pastor Judah, I was driving into work this morning, and there was a car in front of me that had two bumper stickers on it.
Poor choices.
And leaving to the side Dimitri Martin's wonderful joke about how bumper stickers are like shortcuts. They're a way of saying, hey, let's never hang out, which
that's
I think
hilarious.
Is a really funny joke.
That's really funny.
These two bumper stickers were not inflammatory. Mm. They weren't making some controversial statement or whatever. They were just sort of there. And my first thought was, those are weird things to have on your car.
Mm.
And then my second thought was, why am I having an opinion about this? Why do I care what is going on with this person's car? Mm. And I was struck by how quickly I responded to a person I will not speak with and that I do not know, not with curiosity, but with this immediate kind of negativity. I'm guessing I'm not the only one who tends to do this. At least I hope not.
I can't relate.
Why is it that we tend to default to sort of negativity, judgment, questioning so often in so many areas of our lives?
I think it's a couple of things. One, I think that it is just the easier thing to do, right? I think it's like, you know, if you're not going to do the survey on the bottom of your McDonald's receipt unless they got your order wrong,
yeah.
Right? I think it's easier to notice things that make us upset or uncomfortable. Pain is loud.
Yeah.
You know, frustration is loud. And I think, you know, our brains need to take shortcuts because we're processing so much information all of the time. And I think just culturally, we have a habit of one of the shortcuts being that our brains more quickly find the negative things. And this is something that much smarter people than me describe as negativity bias, where our brains just naturally latch on to negative experiences more than positive ones and without a lot of effort.
Yeah.
And doing the opposite is actually a lot of effort, particularly if there are things present that we don't like or disagree with, that then it's even harder to look at somebody and say, how can I find value in you and not be negative.
Well, and it's important to note that for our ancestors, negativity bias was important for survival.
Yeah, but that's because they're like poisonous flowers that could eat you.
Right. So that the point being, the person who saw a stick and thought it was a snake, the consequences of that are fairly small. Whereas the person who saw a snake and thought it was a stick is dead. Right? Like there was a point in our, you know, kind of pre-industrial history where this sort of negativity bias was beneficial, but that no longer benefits us. And yet all of our ancestors with all of their negativity bias are the ones who survived long enough to reproduce. And here we are, right? So there is this sense in which it is very easy for us to be negative. Now, this came to my mind this week because of I subscribed to a new newsletter from a pastor in New York named John Tyson, who is a tremendous preacher, very much worth listening to, Church of the City, New York. And he was talking about how does this apply to the way that we view people, particularly those we love. He cites the research of John Gottman, who I've cited his research in sermons before, and he talked about how successful relationships are ones where we have five positive interactions for every one negative. And how, but also
formula.
How it is so easy to sort of scan for the negative instead of scanning for the positive. And what he prescribed was a concept that I'd never heard it stated in these terms before, but I thought it was really helpful, that he is not prescribing toxic positivity, where we are just sort of so positive all the time that it leaves no room for the expression of negative emotions. And he was also not prescribing emotional repression, where it just sort of pretends everything is fine. Mm. But rather, he was talking about how he is learning, and what he is trying to practice in his life is graceful realism. Graceful realism. And he defines it as this: it is a way of seeing that has the courage to acknowledge both beauty and brokenness, light and shadow, potential and pain. It is the kind of vision that can hold the tension between what is and what could be, between the reality of our struggles and the possibility of transformation. And he says that when he finds himself slipping into criticism, which he acknowledges is something he struggles to do daily, he tries to remember that oftentimes the problem isn't what we're looking at. The problem is how we've trained ourselves to look. And he goes on to cite, I mean, well, I don't know that we can link to this in the show notes, but you can subscribe to his newsletter, check out what he has to say. But he goes on to cite research in neuroplasticity that says we can actually train ourselves to view things a little bit more positively. Now, for you specifically, Pastor Judah, how much of a struggle is this for you? And then in what ways are you kind of working on trying to view the world with kind of through a more gracious lens?
Yeah. I think it's very hard for me, especially because I can end up in echo chambers where there's a lot of, folks who think like me and believe like me. And I push against that all the time. But I think that it has taught me sometimes to make a lot of assumptions about people, and those assumptions are negative. And I'm actually more concerned about the assumptions that are negative, more even than just like, oh, you're just noticing negative things, but like, you're not even noticing negative things.
Yeah.
You're assuming negative things. And I think that one of the ways that I am working through this is, and I think this is one of the ways that you work through bias, period, is whenever you're engaging with a new person, you talked about curiosity. It's essentially that.
Yeah.
But I try to ask like a really stupid question, like one that there's no stakes in. Like, I wonder what his favorite seasoning is.
Just in your mind.
Yeah,
you're
just
not
in my mind.
Interrupting this conversation with.
If he's an apple juice or an orange juice.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that it does is it reminds me that I am talking about a human.
That's good.
And then I can hopefully scan for more curiosity, for more positivity. But even if I'm struggling to find something positive to notice, to even just kind of be reminded that I'm dealing with like a whole entire person who is complicated, who has a long history, who is many things.
Yeah.
And that allows me to, I think, hold at least nuance for that person.
Yeah.
I think the other thing is, I just think that it's critical to be around lots of different types of people.
Yeah.
And what I notice is the folks who struggle the most with this sort of thing are the folks who are in a lot of homogenous spaces.
Yeah.
Because you don't build up, like a part of what builds up the muscle, I talk about travel all the time, and I think that it has so deeply shaped me because I've been in so many places with so many different kinds of people that now difference is not nearly as triggering to the negativity bias as I think it could be.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And that it is far easier to demonize theoretical people or sort of groups 100%. As opposed to an actual human being. I mean, Ben Sasse talks about this in his book, Them, and it's such an important thing that he kind of makes that argument of like a big reason why we hate each other is because we don't know each other.
Yeah.
And we can not humanize each other.
Learn about each other from other people who don't know us.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Another thing I want to reference is a book I read last year, Super Communicators by Charles Duhigg. And he makes the point that even when it comes to things like persuasion, that oftentimes what we we need is not more information. What we need is to be able to humanize each other. So if I can connect with you over something that's similar to that, or if I can connect with you over something, some similarity we have that is maybe unrelated to the topic at hand, that will then help you see me as a human, and we can have a real conversation about data, about what is the best path forward without kind of these ideological walls being put up, which I think is really important. Now, something that John says, Pastor John says in the article, that when we shift to train ourselves to scan for the positive, three things happen in his observation. Number one, we move from cynicism, and that begins to soften into compassion, where we go, instead of just assuming the negative about everyone all the time, we adopt that curiosity that I think that you're describing. Irritation makes space for understanding. And then complaints give way to curiosity. And this is something I would love to say that I've made a lot of progress in this area, but I have such a long way to go. But I remember, you know, a year or so ago, my therapist telling me, Brian, I want you to get into the practice of noticing things, but not having an opinion about them. Mm. Like, okay, that house is painted blue.
That's it.
I don't like it, dislike it. It just is. Yeah. And it was that... It was one of those things where, like, when someone, like, tells you something so simple and you're like, well, and you're like, oh my gosh, I do form an opinion about everything all the time. And cynicism, irritation, complaints. Oh my gosh, I can't believe they chose that color. Oh my gosh, I can't believe they're wearing that shirt. Oh my gosh, I can't believe they have that bumper sticker on their car. I'm like, what am I doing? Instead of going, interesting. I wonder what led them to put that bumper sticker on their car. Oh, okay. I wonder, like, that's interesting that maybe I wonder why they liked that color. So instead of, and then I think even that when it comes to our personal interactions, let's say I'm questioning the shirt you're wearing, which, you know, once family, always family. I can get with that.
Yeah, it's a BYA shirt.
It's a BYA shirt. There you go. Instead of, let's say I want to question you about it. I'm not questioning you in a way that, like, I'm putting you on the defensive. Rather, I'm questioning you from a place of curiosity, going, oh, that's a cool shirt. Like, what does it mean? Right? As opposed to, like, why are you wearing that shirt? Such a different way, I think, of interacting with people where we're now not putting them on the defensive. We're leading with curiosity and we're leading with kind of seeking understanding as opposed to, like, being informed by our judgments all the time.
Yeah, there's also this practice of, before you form your opinion, asking the question, what information don't I have?
Yeah.
You know, what information am I? So I'm thinking about your example of driving this morning, or I think it was this morning you were saying.
Yep.
And, like, if you notice the bumper stickers and then, so what information do I not have?
Totally.
I don't know who this person is. I don't know why they put their stickers on. I don't know what motivated them. I don't know where they got the car. And it just kind of, I think, allows you to kind of pull back and have a wider kind of scope that allow, and I think that allows for some humility, right? Because when you realize, oh, there's actually a lot I don't know about why they painted the house blue or why, you know, Judah is wearing whatever shirt he's wearing. I think that that's how you kind of stir up curiosity.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, in acting, actors are taught a lot that you're actually not really supposed to have an opinion. You, Judah, the actor, should not have an opinion about your character, because the second you're trying to make judgments about the character, then you can't be that character.
Mm.
And I would argue that in a very similar way, that you cannot be with people in the richest ways if your default is to make judgments about them. And I want to acknowledge that I don't think that this is easy. That I think that it actually requires a ton of brain space to deeply consider everybody that you're around. And so I love that the author of one of the articles we were reading talks a lot about, like, starting with the people that you do love.
Yeah.
The people that you do care about.
Yeah.
As you're trying to kind of create that culture within yourself.
Yeah. Well, and what it does for me is, especially I tend to be somebody who I like to improve things. I like to make things better. And the good side of that is I can help things get better. The bad side of that is I can be nitpicky, and I have to be very conscious of that I can be discouraging towards others when maybe my heart is to help, but it's received as, like, oh my gosh, Brian, am I doing anything right? And I've had to be very careful of that, over the years. So to be able to go, actually, I want to try to lead with what is positive And he even recommends this, and this is something I want to try to practice this week. He says, scan for the positive. Be a curator of goodness in your relationships. Write down 5 specific things you value about each person close to you. Share what you see. Watch how it changes not just them, but you as well. And I just think about whether it's with family, whether it's with friends, whether it's with work colleagues, we feel this urgency to point out things that need to be fixed, that I want to somehow learn, and I'm not there yet, to have that same level of urgency to share positive things that I see and to share appreciation. It's a word, and it's a word that if you'll forgive the cliche, I need as much as anyone. And I want to try to practice that this week, and I would encourage others to do the same, to try to adopt that sense of urgency. And I do think there is a training element here.
100%.
And we need to be careful not to like beat ourselves up for 100%. Our first thoughts.
Yeah.
That I think we learn to kind of reform our first thoughts by first noticing them. Wow.
Huh, like the first segment.
Yeah, that's right. Wow, my first thought was judgment over something I have no business judging. Like, okay, now we don't beat ourselves up. We have some compassion for ourselves. We're like, that was a little silly. Let's maybe try not to do that again.
Yeah, I think that there's some value in just like, I would say a first step is just to pay attention to your thoughts, yeah. Right? Pay attention to how often, yeah, I would even keep a tally. Like, yeah. Just see in a day how many opinions that come up quickly, and then how many do you voice,
yeah.
And how many of them are negative.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that this is what Jesus did, and I think it's what we should do.
Graceful realism. It's a beautiful thing. We'll be right back.
We always try to have a little fun on Engaging Culture. And so this week we're playing one of our favorites, Blessed or Stressed.
Oh, it's going to be a good one.
It's going to be good, where both of us are going to share an emerging trend or a new thing that's happening in the world. And we're going to talk about whether we are blessed by it, feeling good about it, or stressed about it. Pastor Brian, what are you noticing in the world?
Okay, I am noticing a news story that is actually happening in 2 different places, from what I can tell, both in Sydney, Australia, and in Brooklyn. I will read you this headline, I'm Pastor Judah. Nervous. This is a good... I found this
Help
like
us,
4 days ago,
Help us,
and
Jesus.
I'm like, this is it. So, here's the headline. Stinky bloom of corpse flower enthralls thousands. Thousands of people in both Sydney and Brooklyn are waiting for hours. In New York, it was up to 3.5 hours to come and see this flower, affectionately known as a corpse flower, that will bloom only every few years for about 24 hours. And the one in Sydney, it releases the people described the smell as wet socks.
Excuse me?
Hot cat food.
Excuse me?
Or rotting possum flesh. 8,000 people viewed it on live stream. And John Simone, the director of horticulture and living collections at the garden where it was, compared the spectacle to Sydney's 2000 Olympics, saying they've had 15,000 people come through the gates before the flower even opened. In Brooklyn... somebody, a gentleman named Elijah Blades, told the Associated Press, it smells like feet, cheese, and rotten meat. It just smelled like the worst possible, I love this so much, worst possible combination of smells. That was disgusting. Pastor Judah, and they named the flower Smellia, by the way, which I thought was very funny. Pastor Judah, are you blessed or stressed by the fact that thousands of our fellow humans... trying not to judge, as we said last time. I don't know where the graceful realism is here. Thousands of our fellow humans, are lining up to get a whiff of the hot cat food, stinky cheese flower.
You know, sometimes I think we ought to bring back shame. Sometimes I think we ought to just bring back shame. Okay, before I answer this question, I do have a question that's going to shape whether this is blessed me or stressed me. Are they charging for people to be able to come and see and smell this flower?
You know, that's a good question, and I'm not sure. At least they're in botanical gardens, so presumably you need to pay admission. Like, the one in Brooklyn is at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, which I'm assuming is not free. So I don't know. I think it is safe to assume probably.
So I have a little venture business proposal for you. You said it smells like feet, cheese, and what now?
Hot cat food.
Hot cat food. I want you to meet me at the Walmart. And I think that we may be able to launch a little business here.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
This is why I'm stressed about it.
Okay.
I'm not even stressed at the, like, grotesqueness of it.
Okay.
I am stressed at how when something becomes exciting, then it becomes exciting for no reason. Like, it's just everybody jumps on. I mean, I'm thinking about the Popeye's chicken sandwich.
Okay.
And you remember all them people
oh, yeah.
was lined up outside? Like, yeah. Popeye's didn't already sell chicken?
Yeah.
It feels like that. And I just don't know why we get so excited about stuff that is gross. And gross stuff that you already have access to. You, woman of God, your husband already has stinky feet and stinky socks. And y'all own a cat. Why are we standing in line outside the New York Botanical Garden House to smell this? And I'm listen, no disrespect, but Sydney and Brooklyn, this does not bode well for you. This does not make me feel like, yeah, I think, listen, you know, everything in Australia can kill you. I think that y'all have been bitten by a little too many spiders and too many snakes. And Brooklyn, listen, nothing is safe about there, and the smog is bad. I just think we ought to pray and intercede for the land.
Now, the flowers are not the same in those places, but they're similar. These quotes are gold. Sydney Botanic Gardens chief scientist Brett Summerall, I liken the smell to a dead possum. Sydney resident Rebecca McGee Collette, who waited 90 minutes to see the flower on Thursday evening, said the flower was beautiful, but the smell was like hot garbage. So you are stressed.
This is the result of gentle parenting. And I don't care how y'all feel about it.
Okay. I am going to frame this only slightly differently. I will say I am blessed by this. Number
Excuse
one,
me.
It is extremely weird. I will grant you that. But number one, I think a sort
this
of a
what
general...
what happens when you only eat eucalyptus leaves.
A general intrigue for new and bizarre experiences. Like, I can get with that. Do I want to go, hang out in the room for an hour with this smelly flower? No, I do not. But flowers, I don't know if you know this, Pastor Judah, typically smell very nice. Mm. And the idea of something that is so bizarre and weird, like, I can get with that. Like, so for example, my parents are traveling right now. They're in New Zealand. And I was just talking to them last night, and they said how they went to this Antarctica museum. And as part of the Antarctica museum, they got to, like, go into a room that was like an experience of the weather in Antarctica. It was like negative something, wind chill factor, storms and all of that. Do I want to do that for an hour? Do I want to live in Antarctica? No, I don't. But the idea of going in there for a minute, sure, let's experience what it's like.
Don't worry about it. I'm going to give you the experience.
So,
I hope I draw you for Secret Santa this year.
I am into... I don't want hot cat food or feet or whatever, but I am blessed by the fact that people are trying out these new experiences, even if they're weird and a little uncomfortable.
I just feel like, though, this should be so far down the list of new experiences. If you have not skydived, if you have never left the country, if you have never had sushi, I just feel like you have options.
That's right.
Before you say, I want to go and smell the flower that smells like hot garbage and bad breath.
They named the flower in Sydney Putricia. Putricia.
Putricia?
Combination of putrid and Patricia.
Yeah, putrid.
I love it. I love
Jesus,
it.
Jesus, come
I'm
back.
I'm into this.
Come back now.
I am into this. All right, what's yours?
I'm okay. Let me just. Recover.
I think I just won the game, even though
I
there
think
is
you
no
did.
Like we. There's not a winners and losers, but I'm gonna claim victory here.
I
Go
think
on.
So. Okay, so many of you are familiar with LinkedIn. It is a traditional networking website where you post basically your resume and you post updates about your professional life.
Yep.
And over the last year or so, there has been a huge change in LinkedIn in that now it has become a place where people are posting humorous content. On purpose, that they are trying to be funny, that they are releasing videos and posts that are supposed to be hilarious and funny and silly. There's a lot of satirical videos up there. And the interesting thing is that this kind of began, according to the internet, in 2019. And since then, LinkedIn has observed a 160% rise in members and in engagement. And people are expressing a desire for humorous content on and in the corporate space. And so one of the results is that now more corporate spaces are implementing humor in the workplace, in the business meeting. Now, this isn't anything new for Bridgeway because we've always been this way.
Yep.
But a lot of other places are doing this too. And that has led to a lot of marketing strategies that are humor-based. One of them being, you may remember that there was this war between like Wendy's, McDonald's, and one other place through their billboards.
Yeah.
But the idea of using your LinkedIn and being silly and funny on there, how do you feel about it? Blessed or stressed?
So LinkedIn, I am stressed by in general because I feel like it is, I mean, it's sort of like professional social media. By professional, I just mean like social media for our professional lives, in that we're all sort of clamoring for attention, and the goal so often is just to get attention rather than serve our audience for the purpose of serving our audience. So like, whatever, I understand it's how the game is played. You got to find business. You got to do all that. So it is what it is. I'm not totally trying to hate on it, but I'm not a big fan. So I love the idea of injecting humor into anything. Mm. And I love the idea of just going, hey, I want to try to be entertaining. I want to try to be funny. I think there is a huge difference between being funny and being overly silly, mm-hmm. because a funny person is able to pick their spots, is able to go, okay, when can I be funny when it's appropriate, and has the capacity to draw back and be serious and professional when seriousness is required. But as a general rule, like, I love to laugh. I love to make people laugh. I love it when people make me laugh. I am down for injecting humor anywhere. I'm curious to see over the long term, how does this balance of trying to be funny while also still, there is a legitimate professional function of LinkedIn
100%.
As kind of meh as about as I might be. I'm curious to see how these live together, but I am blessed by incorporating humor. I would be stressed by it if now all of a sudden it's just everyone's trying to be funny and that's the new thing on LinkedIn.
I'm stressed about this.
Really? Okay.
I'll tell you why. Because one, there's no need for it.
There's always a need for it.
We have plenty of spaces that you can get online and be funny and silly. And I think you ought to protect and preserve your one professional space. The other thing is that humor changes over time. I mean, I went back and I watched a stand-up series by Richard Pryor.
Oh, boy.
And some of the things that man said would never live today.
No, sir.
He would get canceled today. He would get, and maybe rightfully so.
And rightfully so, I would argue.
Right, yeah. And maybe rightfully so. So the point I'm making is that I do not think it is a great idea to take your professional space, the only real space that you have online that's like supposed to be just purely about professionalism, and try to be in there making jokes and dropping, you know, the demure challenge and whatever else have you. I think you're going to look back on it and be embarrassed, and I'm going to look on it and I'm not going to hire you.
Well, and that's where we go. Okay. I think that is where, being funny is a delicate dance, right? How do you be funny without appearing immature? How do you be funny without appearing unprofessional? Can you show personality that is authentic and fun while at the same time highlighting your qualifications for a job? I don't know. I'm with you on the anti-silly, but I think you can be funny without being silly. But also, I don't really care because I don't really use LinkedIn.
You know, I wasn't going to say anything, but I was wondering as I was learning about this, like, but who's still, like, really on LinkedIn like that? Like,
I don't know. I think there are different industries where it's a much bigger deal than it
perhaps,
is maybe for you and me.
But, you know, my industry is kind of not that way.
Yes. Whether you are on LinkedIn or not, we appreciate you taking the time to give this episode some of your attention. Hope you enjoyed it. If you did, leave us a rating or review. We'll be back next week. Hopefully, Pastor Josh will come back from his vacation and join us.
But, I hope so, because we'll see. Going to Thailand soon.
All right. Oh, goodness. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time on Engaging Culture.